I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Polls show the two presidential candidates came out of last night's debate pretty much the way they went in, with Barack Obama leading among voters. For a fact check of last night's debate, you can go to our website, here-now.org. But right now, we want to shed some light on one issue that flared up last night. ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. The group is praised by some communities for its work with low-income Americans and vilified by some Republicans for cases of voter registration fraud. Last night, McCain tried to tie Obama to the group, in one exchange managing to connect ACORN, Obama, and the former radical, now college professor, William Ayers.
While you were on the board of the Woods Foundation, you and Mr. Ayers together, you sent $230,000 to ACORN.
That's absolutely not true.
And the facts are facts.
Well, and Barack Obama also said he had no connection to any voter registration by ACORN.
The only involvement I've had with ACORN was I represented them alongside the U.S. Justice Department in making Illinois implement a motor voter law that helped people get registered at DMVs.
We're going to hear from an ACORN worker in a moment, but first, a look at the group. ACORN works on issues ranging from wages to housing and employs 13,000 workers to canvass for new voters in primarily disenfranchised low- and moderate-income neighborhoods. In casting that net, they admit they come up with some fraudulent registrations. You've probably heard by now, in one case, Batman filled out a voter registration card collected by ACORN. Well, the group is being investigated in several states, and Sarah Palin fires up crowds with the mantra, "We can't allow leftist groups like ACORN to steal this election." But ACORN says faulty registration cards are a small percentage of the 1.3 million new voters the group has added to the rolls. Well, how wide is the problem? What is real? Evan Perez covers the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal. He's done a detailed report on ACORN. Hi, Evan.
Hello, how are you?
Good. And I want to go first to some of the accusations made last night of ties to Barack Obama. Now, Obama said again that he did, along with the Justice Department, represent ACORN and others in that mid-90s case that they won that created these motor voter laws in Illinois, allowing people to register to vote when they get their license. But what about the charge from McCain last night that the Obama presidential campaign years later gave ACORN over $800,000?
The truth is that there is a little bit more to it than what the Obama campaign has been saying. For example, last year the Obama campaign hired a third-party group to do some work for it, and part of that was subcontracted to ACORN for some door-knocking and get-out-the-vote effort.
This was just get-out-the-vote, not voter registration, and it was during the primary.
That is correct. And it is true also that that ACORN's PAC endorsed Obama during the primaries. Obviously, I mean, the Republicans find some trouble in that because they look at it and wonder how can a group that was for Obama during the primaries can suddenly be bipartisan now.
Well, we're going to ask the group about that, but they say they have a firewall. They were never paid by the Obama campaign during the general election campaign outside of the primary, and they were never paid for voter registration.
And that's true. And obviously, the Republicans wanted to make that link more clear. And it's true, the organization does a lot of its work, almost all of its work, in places, low-income neighborhoods, minority neighborhoods that tend to lean Democrat.
Well, if you say the Obama campaign may be making a little less of their relationship than there is the McCain campaign making too much of it? McCain also sort of scored a trifecta here, lumping together Obama, William Ayers, and ACORN. When Ayers and Obama served on the Woods Foundation board, and gave $300,000 to ACORN. That was the charge McCain made last night.
Again, definitely they're exaggerating it. It's a charity that has given to ACORN even before Obama was on the board. It wasn't like because Obama was on the board that ACORN got this money. And according to the state authorities, it's about $200,000, I think, between 2000 and 2002.
Well, let's take a look at the fraud cases because your paper has a pretty large list of states that are looking at ACORN registration cards. Can you give us just a few examples?
There's about a dozen states that are looking at this in some way, some fashion. We know that there's investigations in Indiana. We know that there is investigations in Nevada where the Secretary of State there raided an ACORN office and says that there have been registrations in the name of members of the Dallas Cowboys.
Who, of course, play in Texas.
Play in Texas. Yes, exactly. And then there's in New Mexico, where I was last week, where, you know, the FBI is looking at about 1,400 registrations that are suspect and probably fraudulent. And then, of course, there's Florida, where there's instances of Mickey Mouse registering to vote. Again, it's an Acorn registration. In all these cases, it's very, very difficult for you to make the link from voter registration fraud to then try to determine whether these people are going to actually turn up and vote in November.
Well, this is what Acorn says. I mean, they tell you, look, there's a huge difference between registration fraud and actual voter fraud, that Acorn has thousands of workers and has made changes in how they pay their workers and how they check these cards in order to reduce any kind of fraud. Tell us about some of those changes they've made.
In the past, Acorn used to pay its workers per registration that they turned in. So they've changed it to now an hourly rate, whereby they pay workers work hourly, and then they try to encourage them to get as many registrations as they can. There are some markers that they have to meet in order to keep their jobs. You know, and that is still producing some instances of where workers are making these up.
Acorn says they've instituted a pretty good backup check system. What's that?
Every registration that is brought in, a supervisor looks at it, makes sure that it looks kosher, and then they turn it over to a call center, which makes it up to three attempts to contact each voter to determine that they're, you know, who they say they are. And then when they find suspect applications, the Acorn people put a cover sheet on the application, and when they turn it into the local election officials, they flag them as potentially fraudulent. And that's a key part of this, because it's not as if Acorn is turning these in and trying to pass them off. The organization is flagging the applications itself. Which in many states they're legally required to do. They can't discard an application just because they suspect that it's fraudulent.
Yeah, because then that would lead to charges of throwing away potentially good registration cards for political reasons.
Exactly.
Well, and we understand that once these cards are from any registration group are sent to election boards, they're matched with licenses and social security numbers. And if someone does show up to vote after a registration card that's been flagged, then they're given a provisional ballot at the voting place because they've been flagged. There are questions. So is Acorn right to say that there are backup systems at the state as well?
There are. And if you talk to local elections officials, I mean, obviously a lot of them are a little overwhelmed with the number of problem applications. But they all point to the fact that they have their own systems in place that try to catch these things. And if you look at the number that have been flagged, then it probably is an indication that their system is working. And there is this the reality that when you show up to vote, and if you are a suspect, you have one of those suspect applications, you'll be asked to prove your identity. In some states, it's a photo ID. In many states, there are other forms of identification that are required. So there are a lot of backups that would seek to stem the possibility of fraud.
You've told us that there are other voter registration systems. Republicans may have one, but it's more of a internet-based. But we spoke with University of Utah Professor Thad Hall, who said the real problem here is that there isn't one national system. Tell us more about that.
Well, that is exactly right. I mean, you have a system in place that is very error-prone, and we're demanding precision from a system that is just not set up that way. You have other countries where you don't have to make this grand effort to try to register to vote, where your registration follows you wherever you are. If the IRS can find you every year to send you paperwork for your taxes, why can't your voter registration follow you? And so we have a system that's also, I mean, by its very nature, it's very partisan. Your local registrar is elected, and he's a Democrat or Republican. It's a very partisan system, and it's always prone to these types of fights. And when you have a close election, this is what happens.
Evan Perez of the Wall Street Journal. Evan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, Evan also writes that John McCain has his own ties to Acorn. He spoke at their 2006 immigration reform rally in Miami. Well, let's turn now to Austin King, spokesperson for Acorn. And Austin, let's start with, in your words, what work did you do for Barack Obama?
We did get out the vote work, so we knocked on doors, made phone calls, staged rallies, tried to pull people out to the polls. But the voter registration work that we're talking about, we've never gotten a cent from the Obama campaign for that, nor from the federal government, which is another accusation that's been levied against us. The voter registration work we've done, which we're very proud of, 1.3 million new voters, has been entirely funded privately.
So what about the registrations for Mickey Mouse, Batman, you know, people on the Dallas Cowboys? Were those workers fired who collected those?
They absolutely were fired. This is a problem that we've been struggling with and I think conquering by a number of internal quality control measures. We have no tolerance for fraud. We actually make all of our employees sign an affidavit that they won't do this exact kind of thing, engaging in these fraudulent voter registration applications like Mickey Mouse and Tony Romo. And every time we catch a canvasser doing that, they are immediately fired, and we actually turn them over to local law enforcement authorities for prosecution.
And now the FBI is investigating in some states. The Secretary of State raided the Las Vegas office, and 50 of the 700 Acorn workers there were fired. So internal and external pressure on Acorn. What do you think about the accusation, though, that you're just doing this registration in neighborhoods that might vote Democratic?
Well, that's actually an accusation we wear on our sleeves. Acorn is an organization of low and moderate income families, and we believe passionately that this country does not work well for low and moderate income families. One of the reasons is that we don't have a lot of clout. And frankly, that's because on Election Day, the electorate that shows up in America's polling places does not look like America. There are far too few people of color that show out to the polls and vote. There are far too few low-income Americans that show up and vote. And one of the reasons, along with fighting for the minimum wage and paid sick days and against foreclosures, why we do voter registration drives at Acorn is that we believe that putting 1.3 million new low-income voters on the polls absolutely increases our power and allows us to change the political dynamic in this country so that low and moderate income Americans can participate in its electoral process and then in the political process with more clout.
Well, Austin, explain to some people who might be saying, well, geez, I know how to register to vote. Why do they need help registering to vote?
Well, the United States has the lowest voter registration rate and lowest voter participation rate of any Western democracy in the world. And that's because we have systems that are actually designed to prevent people from voting. Many of the voter registration laws we have today are direct outgrowths of Jim Crow era laws. And so I wish that we got put out of business. Let me just state that very unequivocally. Put Acorn out of business, make a universal voter registration program in the United States, and we will happily go back to working on the minimum wage and paid sick days and foreclosures, because it is really hard work. Unfortunately, it's absolutely necessary work if we're going to fulfill the promise of our democracy. And so we have to go out and register voters because no one else will.
Well, you say, put us out of business. And some people are saying, with all the other work that you do, why do you go into voter registration outside of what you've just said, that you want to bring this opportunity to low-income voters? But given the accusations that it's allowed Republicans to make because of the cases of voter registration fraud, why not get out of the business of voter registration and take that spotlight off the Democratic Party?
Well, frankly, this has nothing to do with the Democratic Party. This is a nonpartisan voter registration drive.
But in effect, it allows.
I will concede that it allows Republicans to make these histrionic attacks against Acorn and low-income Americans, which are a distraction from the fundamental issues that we face. But still, despite all the negative publicity we've gotten in the last 2 weeks, I believe in my heart of hearts that America would be a poorer country today and a lesser democracy if those 1.3 million voters were not on the rolls. And signing those people up to vote is one of the most profound acts of patriotism that we can do. And I think, frankly, that's one of the reasons that we do it. It is about America.
Austin King of Acorn. We're going to be back with more later, what Joe the Plumber actually said, but back in a bit with Austin here and now. Welcome back. We've been learning about the housing advocacy group Acorn with their spokesperson, Austin King, who says, the group has been as unhappy with Democrats as they've been with Republicans about issues like housing policies. Austin, we just heard from a Wall Street Journal reporter, Evan Paris, who says, in fact, you say his account of your group is fair. But separately, the uber-conservative Wall Street Journal editorial board called your group a militant advocacy group, a shady outfit that uses government dollars to lobby for larger government. They also accuse Acorn of being a major contributor to the subprime mortgage crisis. They say you pushed and coerced lenders into making these bad loans to people who couldn't afford homes. Let's talk about that. What is your response to that?
This isn't just the Wall Street Journal. It's actually the John McCain campaign himself put out an ad last week that accused Acorn of the same thing, of pushing banks to make risky loans. The reality is 180 degrees opposite. Acorn, for the last decade, has been the nation's leading organization against predatory lending practices. It's actually my full-time job to fight against predatory lending, so I'm very familiar with the work that we do. We actually protest against banks that do issue risky predatory loans to our members because they strip equity and wealth out of low-income communities. And yes, we picket banks, but it's not because they're not issuing enough risky loans. It's because they're issuing too many risky loans, and we want that practice to stop.
Well, in fact, we've done a number of stories on this. Underreported is the number of foreclosures of middle and upper income homeowners.
Now, the foreclosure crisis began in low-income urban America. In fact, we can trace this back to 1999 when lenders like New Century, AmeriQuest, and Household were peddling really toxic mortgages in low-income neighborhoods that were cash poor but equity rich. And so it was a way of stealing the wealth and equity out of those neighborhoods. But with the subprime boom that came about with the liberalization of regulations of the financial services industry, yes, these predatory mortgages spread from the inner cities to the suburbs to the exurbs. And frankly, the entire country is now caught up in this crisis because of the lack of regulation on these toxic mortgages. And John McCain has, in his entire career, never mentioned the word predatory lending, as far as I know. He just in March finally acknowledged that there was a foreclosure crisis, and Arizona is the third highest foreclosure-rated state in the country. And Acorn's been warning that this crisis would come for the better part of a decade, and frankly, if we had any power in Congress and they had listened to us, we could have avoided this crisis. What makes this crisis so tragic is that it was predictable and preventable.
Austin King is National Director of Acorn's Financial Justice Center. Austin, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It was a real pleasure.
Okay, well, one result of the mortgage disaster is the current financial crisis. Let's check in on the economy. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said today that the economy will get worse before it gets better. He also said he's not proud of the mistakes that were made, including failures of the regulatory system. He did say he feels the government is on the right track now. So why are we seeing such wild days on Wall Street? A new report today shows consumer prices haven't risen. That's good news because it means we're not seeing inflation. But the bad news, another report shows people aren't spending their money. And that may be one of the things behind the wild up and downs on Wall Street. We're joined by New York Times national economics correspondent Peter Goodman. So, Peter, on Monday, the Dow with a near-record increase, 936 points. Yesterday, a drop of more than 700, up and down today. What's happening?
Well, there was a sense of relief on Monday that governments around the world managed to put together this collective effort to unclog the financial system. And there was a sense of, okay, thank goodness we're not going to experience the cataclysm. This isn't, you know, the beginning of the next Great Depression. But then in subsequent days, the markets sort of pulled back and said, well, it turns out that the economy's actually been in some serious distress for many months, and not only has that not gone away, but the financial crisis has amplified a lot of the problems that were pre-existing, such as housing prices are continuing to fall, the job market has lost 700,000 plus jobs since the beginning of the year, so you're taking paychecks out of the economy just as housing prices are falling, all of which means spending power is declining, and it's become a downward spiral. So, you know, people lose their jobs or they lose hours at work, they have less to spend. The businesses that then are getting fewer dollars start to cut their people or cut their hours, and down we go. And, you know, that was here before the financial crisis, and it's still with us and intensifying.
Well, we know that the president announced plans to pump $250 billion into banks to get credit flowing. That, you know, hasn't happened yet. Also, on October 27th, the Federal Reserve is going to start getting involved in these IOUs that banks and businesses make to each other to keep payrolls going. You know, that hasn't happened yet, obviously. But, you know, the Secretary of the Treasury said, start making loans to each other. Why are banks leery? Tell us more about what's going on.
Well, if you're a bank, you're happy on the one hand that the financial system is now going to get some money from the government, that there are these efforts to shore up the financial system. I mean, the biggest problem was that banks were sitting on bad loans, didn't have enough money reserved against future bad loans. They just simply didn't have enough capital. So that problem is now being addressed to a certain extent, though, you know, as you know, the money hasn't actually been delivered yet. But there's a bigger problem, which is there are still losses waiting to be recognized from our excessive, largely real estate-centered, excessive bit of investment. And so there are bad mortgages waiting to be tallied up. And meanwhile, banks are staring at an economy that's clearly deteriorating, and they're thinking to themselves, well, do we really want to bet our money in such uncertain and potentially really troubling conditions?
Well, and Peter, just briefly, some have said also that we became a country that was based on money and finance and that as a business. And today we have a report that shows that industrial production fell 3.5%. That's the biggest drop in 30 years. I know that that's bad, but I'm not quite sure why. Tell us why that's connected to all this.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you're noting, we have gone over the recent decades. I mean, this is a large, deeply set transition. We've gone from an economy where we largely make stuff, where, manufacturing was once twice as big a part of our economy as it is now. I mean, if you go back to the 50s and 60s, and meanwhile, financial services has gotten bigger and bigger. So in essence, we've gone from an economy that makes stuff into an economy that figures out reasons to make money move around. And that hasn't worked out really well. So now we're trying to get back to a traditional sort of economy where we hire people in factories and in service-producing companies who do things that are of value and that people will pay for. And that's now declining. Factory production is down. There's just simply less demand.
Peter Goodman, New York Times National Economics Correspondent. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And speaking of doing things the traditional way, tomorrow on Here and Now, a bank that just takes in deposits and makes loans. That's it. The good old-fashioned way. That's tomorrow. Back after the news, Here and Now. So it probably goes without saying that business is going to boom for Joe the Plumber, the star of last night's presidential debate. But today, many Americans are wondering, who is Joe the Plumber? We thought it might be worthwhile to hear the exchange that launched last night's mentions. It occurred when Senator Obama was campaigning in Toledo last Sunday, and Joe Wurzelbacher approached Obama on the rope line and told the candidate that he was getting ready to buy a small plumbing business that makes just over $250,000 a year. Let's listen to some excerpts.
I mean, I've worked hard. I'm a plumber. You know, I work, 10, 12 hours a day.
Absolutely.
And I'm, buying this company, and I'm going to continue to work that way.
Right.
Now, if I buy another truck and add something else to it and, build the company, I'm getting taxed more and more.
Well, you're
fulfilling, the American dream. So
here's a way of thinking about it. How long have you been a plumber? How long have you been working?
15 years.
Okay, so over the last 15 years, when you weren't making $250,000, you would have been getting a tax cut from me. So you'd actually have more money, which means you would have saved more, which means that you would have gotten to the point where you could build your small business quicker than under the current tax code. So there are two ways of looking at it. I mean, one way of looking at it is, now that you've become more successful,
Through hard work,
you don't want to be taxed as much.
Exactly.
Which I understand. But another way of looking at it is, 95% of folks who are making less than $250,000, they may be working hard too.
Yeah.
But they're being taxed at a higher rate than they would be under mine. Now, look, nobody likes high taxes.
No, not
right?
at all.
Of course not. So, but what's happened is that we've cut taxes a lot for folks like me who make a lot more than $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't given a break to folks who make less. And as a consequence, the average wage and income for just ordinary folks, the vast majority of Americans, has actually gone down over the last 8 years. I do believe that for folks like me who are, have worked hard but, frankly, also been lucky, I don't mind paying just a little bit more than the waitress who I just met over there whose things are slow and she can barely make the rent, because my attitude is that if the economy is good for folks from the bottom up, it's going to be good for everybody. If you've got a plumbing business, you're going to be better off if you've got a whole bunch of customers who can afford to hire you. And right now, everybody's so pinched that business is bad for everybody. And I think when you spread the wealth around, it's good for everybody. But I respect what you do, and I respect your question.
So, would Barack Obama raise Joe the Plumber's taxes? Well, according to NPR's fact checkers, if, after Joe pays all his expenses, he does make more than $250,000, his taxes would go up under Obama's plan. Conversely, under Obama's plan, Americans making under $250,000 would have three times the income tax break they'd get from McCain. As to John McCain's charge that Joe Wurzelbacher would have to provide health insurance for his workers if he buys that company or pay a fine if he doesn't under Obama's plan, plan, NPR said no. A small company like the one Joe was talking about would be exempt. Well, last night's debate was watched by millions of people overseas, including Americans living abroad, some of them wondering if it's time to come home. Now, some angry Republicans have been mumbling about leaving the country if the Democrat becomes president. If they do leave, they may cross paths with some returning Democrats. Producer Ian Mount joined a group of Democratic expats watching the debate in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Are each of you tonight willing to sit at this table and say to each other's face what your campaigns and people?
In the cavernous Sacramento Resto Bar in the Palermo neighborhood of Buenos Aires, several hundred Americans are gathered to watch the third and final presidential debate at an event sponsored by the Argentine chapter of Democrats Abroad, an organization dedicated to, you guessed it, getting out the vote among Democrats living overseas.
Attendance has been tremendous. For the first debate, we stopped counting at 300.
That's the local Democrats Abroad chairman, Yankee Mike Skoranek. Much of the raucous crowd here is college-aged, as Buenos Aires is a hot study abroad spot. But there are quite a few older faces. In recent years, Buenos Aires has become a prime destination for Americans looking to expatriate themselves. Most were attracted by the tango and great steak, but some also felt pushed by their dislike of the Bush administration. For many of those, there's a lot at stake in this debate. The election will have at least some effect on when they move back home.
Like, you know, take a year off, go somewhere else, experience the world, and come back when it's all fixed. At this time, we thought, you know, we'd have maybe even Hillary as president, but, you know.
40-year-old Michelle Kiley quit her New York advertising job 8 months ago to study Spanish for a year.
I'm an optimist, and I really hope that Obama wins, so in my head, that's what I'm picturing in the future. If he doesn't win, I think it'll be a disaster at home, and I'd be a little afraid to go back.
Like Michelle, many of the Americans plan to stay in Buenos Aires for a short period, only to fall in love with the city and extend their stay. For them, the election won't determine so much if they will return, but if they feel that they can. Caitlin Kelly worked as a newspaper photographer in Riverside, California, before she moved to the city 9 months ago.
This election, what is it? How does this election affect your sort of living situation over the next few years?
Well, if McCain wins, I'm not going home, probably. Maybe I can hang out here in Buenos Aires for the next 4 years. If Obama wins, well, I would be really happy, and I'd probably still continue to live here, but I'd feel like I have a country to go home to. I fear losing my country, definitely, and becoming kind of adrift in the world.
Not every expatriate is quite as willing to laugh about the situation. For some of the older ones, the U.S. has been lost.
I've been very political all my life, since the 60s. Worked for Jerry Brown, was in the streets, got my head busted by cops in the 60s.
Tom McCallum is a 60-year-old architect who moved from Seattle to Mexico 4 years ago, and from there to Buenos Aires.
Say with the different possible outcomes of this election, would you go back with either of the outcomes?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, when I see footage of Sarah Palin stirring up the knuckle draggers, basically performing like a purebred National Socialist Nazi, I look at the States and it scares me.
So
it really scares me.
So that's it. Why are you here tonight if you're going to stay anyway?
I want to see a landslide. I want to see policy change.
All this leaves one burning question. What do the Republicans in Buenos Aires think of the election? I asked Caitlin Kelly.
So is there an active Republicans abroad here that you know?
Not that I know of. I don't think I've yet met a Republican here. I've met some people who are pretty close to independent, maybe a Libertarian or two, but I have yet to meet a Republican overseas who wasn't just on vacation.
In the end, most of the debate watchers here in Buenos Aires say they will return to the United States, no matter who wins the election. It's just a matter of time. In the case of the local Democrats Abroad chairman, Yankee Mike Skoranek, that may be a lot of time.
I truly would like to be buried in Chicago, my hometown. so that I can continue my activity with the Democratic Party.
The View from Buenos Aires was produced by Ian Mount. Well, still ahead today, music from the Gabe Dixon Band. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, we've been taking time out to learn about some of the terms we're hearing during the financial crisis. Yesterday, it was clawback, the concept that highly paid CEOs can be forced to return some of their compensation. A clawback is in the federal government's bailout plan. Barry Ritholtz is CEO and director of the New York equity research firm Fusion IQ. He writes the blog, The Big Picture. Barry, yesterday it was clawback. Today, a phrase that popped up Monday when the Dow jumped up by more than 900 points, a phrase that also, in a way, has claws. It's the unfortunate dead cat bounce, with deep apologies to animal lovers. What does that mean?
You know, Wall Street is known for having all these lovely, very, very vivid phrases describing the action of the markets. Dead cat bounce is a classic description of you get a big sell-off in the market, and then you get a little bit of a rally, and people look at it and say, hey, is this the beginning of a new bull market? If you were to throw a cat off the top of the Empire State Building, after it drops 100 stories, even when it hits the pavement, it's going to bounce a little bit. Oh. And that's the visual image that traders have created to say, hey, even after, you know, you plummet 100 stories, you're still going to bounce. And so sometimes you see the market down a tremendous amount, and then you see a rally, and people say, gee, why are the markets rallying? Yesterday they hated them, today they like them, and it's, hey, you know, it's a dead cat bounce. By the way, that happens to be one of the milder expressions. There are others that just aren't suitable for family radio.
Okay. Well, and my cat is wearing earplugs today. So this is a phrase that was bandied about on Monday, this past Monday, when there was the huge bounce in the market after such a terrible week on news of some of the new government plans. But that, in other words, that was not real. That's not the real recovery there, because the market, you know, has been up and down since.
Actually, I'm going to tell you, Monday was not a classic dead cat bounce.
Ah.
Sometimes it helps to think of the stock market as if it's a spring. And when it gets too extended in either direction, it tends to snap back towards the middle. The mathematicians call it reversion to the mean. So when things get way too frothy and everybody's all excited and the bull market is in full throat and 10,000, 12,000, 15,000, everybody's all excited, you tend to eventually have that reverse. And the same thing happens to the downside. When you see the worst week in markets history, when you see a market down 48% over the course of 12 months, that just tells you that spring stretched too far in one direction, and it tends to come back. You know, this sell-off from October 07 to October 08, this is the third worst sell-off. It's the most we've gone without having a 10% recovery in the history of the market. And the two prior examples that you went a little further than this without a 10% recovery, one was, I believe, 1929, and the other was 1932. If you look at from the bottom on Friday to where Monday closed, it was like an 1,800-point Dow swing, almost a 20% move. So I would tell you, over the course of a session and a half, to see 1,800-point moves, that's not a dead cat bounce. But if you look at every other rally over the past 12 months, they've all turned out to be dead cat bounces.
As we now see that they were not really recoveries, they were just little bounces.
Just a bounce.
Bounces
that's
back
right.
up. Well, we want to note a blog in the Huffington Post even referred to Sarah Palin as giving John McCain's campaign a dead cat bounce, at least initially. So the term has gone way beyond the financial world.
You know, it's funny because I saw that headline and I went and looked at the polls, and they actually misused that phrase, because the way you would see the dead cat bounce is not when you're starting low and moving higher. But look at McCain's polling as of this week. If we see the McCain numbers start to move up as we get a little closer to the election, but fail to close the gap and it's a kind of too little too late, that would be a perfect example of a dead cat bounce.
Again, unfortunate use of words, but we get your point. And by the way, it's also a band. This music we're listening to is by the jazz ensemble Dead Cat Bounce, featuring one of our colleagues at WBUR here in Boston, Charlie Colhase, on sax. It's called Hepcat Revival. Dead Cat Bounce, the band. Barry Ritholtz, CEO and director of the New York equity research firm Fusion IQ, also writes the blog The Big Picture and is author of the upcoming book Bailout Nation, How Easy Money Corrupted Wall Street. Barry, our walking dictionary, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And if you have a word you don't understand, send it to here-now.org. In 1 minute, the guy who said to Paul McCartney, well, I really don't want to tour with you, I'm too busy. That's in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. That's the song Sirens from the new CD by the Gabe Dixon Band. Gabe Dixon, piano, Winston Harrison on bass, and John O'Ricks playing the drums. The band formed 9 years ago when they were students at the University of Miami. This is their third recording, but in between, Gabe Dixon has done some high-profile moonlighting, including playing keyboards on Paul McCartney's 2001 CD, Driving Rain. And Gabe Dixon joins us from the studios of WPSU in State College, Pennsylvania. Gabe, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course, we want to talk about the new CD, which, by the way, is titled The Gabe Dixon Band. But we've got to ask you about something we heard about you and Paul McCartney. Now, you were, as we said, you played on his CD. You were in his band at the Concert for New York, that benefit after the 9/11 attacks. And then Paul McCartney, now this is Sir Paul McCartney, offered you the keyboard slot on his world tour, and you said what?
I did turn him down.
Yeah, no, I think, is what you said. Why?
Well, that was not an easy decision because I love Paul and his music, and he was such a huge, huge influence on me as a musician. And, you know, I just was faced with a situation where I had a record that had just been finished, was about to be released on a major label. We had tour dates booked. And I kind of had to decide, well, what is it what I really want to do with my life? What do I really, what really brings me alive? And so after a lot of prayer and meditation and thought about it, I decided that I needed to go for my own dreams.
So big decision for you, and it seems to have paid off because critics are just loving your CD. The newspaper in your hometown, The Tennessean, compared your new CD to early Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, Carole King, and James Taylor.
I'll gladly sit in that company anytime because those are some of the greatest songwriters and artists ever, you know.
Well, and how would you define your sound? Because we know you come from Nashville. Is it Nashville, influence? I mean, how would you describe it?
Well, it's definitely Nashville influenced. It might not be the Nashville that has presented itself to be in the last several decades, but, you know, I grew up in Nashville, so I saw a different Nashville than I think the rest of the world necessarily knows about. I grew up going to Blair School of Music at Vanderbilt and got to watch people like Bela Fleck and the great classical folks there. And, you know, Nashville has a great blues and funk and rock scene. So that's sort of the side of Nashville that I was immersed in growing up.
And we can hear it in your music. And we also hear your strong feelings about home in your music as well. At least three songs talk about going home, or finding your way home, or being far from home. Let's listen to one. This is Five More Hours. I'm almost home. I got five more hours of highway. Five more hours to go. Five more hours of highway till I'm in the place I know. Heaven only knows the time I've wasted. So close now I can almost taste. Five More Hours, a song about leaving New York, going back to Nashville. And it sounds like some sort of turning point. Are we hearing that as well? Or?
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up in Nashville and kind of went off to school in Miami and met my band and went up to New York. And we, you know, kind of, it was sort of this grand adventure odyssey. And in the end, I realized that I needed to go back home and sort of restart.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, what came from that, you know, the idea of regrouping. You now have this band. Tell me about their sound. There's no guitar, we think. But your bandmate Winston Harrison plays something like a guitar, a mandator, a mandator?
A mandotar, yeah. Oh. It's an instrument that he just kind of took a guitar and modified it to have four strings and tuned it like a mandolin.
Is there a place where we can hear this converted guitar? Is there a song you'd recommend?
The most interesting stuff he does is on Sirens.
Ask you about your playing on the piano. You know, we can, not that it's derivative, but we can hear some Bruce Hornsby, we hear Elton John. Who influenced you?
Early 70s, Elton John, the Beatles, and you know, a lot. I kind of just started with my parents' record collection, to be honest. They had a lot of great albums from that era. You know, Paul Simon, Still Crazy After All These Years, I remember wearing that record out, and you know, Ray Charles and Joe Cocker and, you know, Joni Mitchell, the band, Allman Brothers, you know, that's sort of where I started to discover music on my own. And as far as piano players go, honestly, Reese Wynans was a huge influence on me. He played with Stevie Ray Vaughan and has gone on to play with a lot of other folks. And he's a Nashville native, so I used to sneak down to the Bluebird Cafe, which was right down the street from where I grew up, and watch him play in bands there, and just studied what he did. And he's such a great, like, boogie woogie blues kind of piano player. Him and Chuck Lavelle and Matt Rawlings, who was another great Nashville piano player, Dr. John, those are my early piano influences. And then, of course, I went to college and got more into some jazz stuff, you know, Keith Jarrett and Bill Evans and folks like that. And I'm constantly discovering new things that hopefully filter in somehow to what I do.
Well, let's hear how they get through that filter until you're gone. Well, Gabe Dixon, you were talking about being influenced musically by your parents' record collection, and I'm wondering if you were influenced by the records, because the picture on the cover of the new CD, the Gabe Dixon Band, shows you and the band members standing on the front porch of an old house, and it looks so much like that cover of the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album. They're sitting on an old couch on the porch of some dilapidated house, and I'm just wondering, was that deliberate?
It was deliberate. Not necessarily that we wanted to copy that specific photo, but we did find the guy who took the photo, Henry Diltz, who's just a wonderful photographer and a wonderful guy. And we said, gosh, you know, we love the photos he's done. He did that, the one of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. He did the Morrison Hotel by the Doors. Right. He did a bunch of classic albums. And we said, let's send him the album and see if he likes it and see if he'd agree to, you know, spend the day with us shooting some photos, and sure enough, he did, and we're really glad we got to have that experience with him. And I'm really happy with how it turned out.
Well, you know, you just got me to Google the Henry Diltz website, and there's Joni Mitchell looking out of the window on that cover.
Oh, that's a gorgeous, gorgeous photo.
Yep, and there's the young Bob Dylan with the harmonica to his lips, and there's Jimi Hendrix with the jacket with the, what do you call it, the tassels around it. Oh, Paul and Linda hugging. I mean, yeah, these are iconic photos, and it's not there now, but maybe someday the Gabe Dixon Band will be on that homepage, too. That's Gabe That's Gabe Dixon, leader of the Gabe Dixon Band. Their self-titled new CD is out now, and the band's on tour, so for more, go to our website, here-now.org. Gabe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.